music this week for Open Air. Instead, courtesy of the early music group Ostraca, a live background to the show introduction this week. We'll meet the members of Ostraca, learn about their instruments, and hear more from them this hour. They're the opening ensemble for the San Francisco Early Music Society's 2013-14 season, which gets underway this weekend. Legendary dancer-choreographer Bill T. Jones shares highlights from his long career in dance and details about the exhibition of his works and other celebratory events at the Yerba Buena Center, which includes a world premiere and a West Coast premiere of his works. Maureen Dixon from the Yerba Buena Center is also here. Plus, critic Peter Robinson offers a sneak preview of the major David Hockney exhibit coming to the De Young. And we can't let the birthday of Giuseppe Green, Joe Verdi, go unnoticed, so we'll find some time for a touch of Joe Green before the hour concludes. Stay with us. That's a gavotte from Boismortier, music that will be heard this weekend as part of the San Francisco Early Music Ensemble. Three of those members of Ostraca are in studio now, which you just heard live as theme music for Open Air. Josh Lee, viola da gamba, John Lenti on lute, and David Walker on baroque guitar. Let's hear some more music from them, and then we'll talk here in studio.
Thank you.
Music performed live here at KALW in Studio A by Ostraca. Ostraca is Josh Lee, John Lenti, and David Walker. Josh Lee was the soloist featured on that particular trio. Josh, maybe you could tell us a little bit about what we just heard.
So those were two arias or songs written by Michel Corrette, who coincidentally is the only composer who will be performing works by this weekend, who actually survived the French Revolution. Everybody else either passed away or maybe worse.
Yeah, I should say.
But he was a guy that had his finger well on the pulse of what was popular in Paris at the time. And we play a lot of his music just because it's not very French. It's very referential to a lot of things happening in Italian music at the time, as opposed to more French style that was happening.
The instrument you're using is a precursor to what would be considered a modern cello. What is the instrument called? And maybe you could describe it to people.
It's here. It's called a viola da gamba. This is a bass viola da gamba, and a viola da gamba is a family of instruments that was actually parallel to the cellos. They're not really related. It's actually more closely related to a guitar.
Interesting, but it's played upright like a cello.
Played upright like a cello, and it's got a bow, except you hold the bow underhanded, kind of like what you might see some double bass players in symphonies do today. But the big thing that makes the two big things that are different from a cello, first, it's got seven strings. The cello has four. And the other thing is it's got frets, just like a guitar, which it gives it a more... maybe a nasal sound. We don't vibrate as much as like a violin or a cello would. And it's also built to play chords, which I think some of the music we might play later, you'll hear a bit of that for sure. But I always tell people if they're not sure what it is, it's about half guitar, half cello. It's about the best way to describe it.
You can't really hold it up to the microphone for people to see very well.
It's too bad because she's really pretty.
It's got a beautiful, what do you call the top piece there?
It's a lot of violins and cellos had scrolls, which we're all familiar with. But these instruments, because they were kind of associated with their aristocrats and fancy folk in the 18th and 17th century, a lot of them had heads carved. So this instrument's got a nice, sweet-looking lady with a wreath of flowers around her hair. She's a pretty girl.
That's Josh Lee, the founder of Ostraca. We'll talk more with him about the philosophy behind the ensemble. But I want to also introduce David Walker, who's playing... tell us about your instruments. I want to call it a guitar, but
it is a guitar.
It is a guitar, all right.
This is a guitar. It's a copy of an instrument that would have been made in Paris in 1686 by... there were a family of guitar makers called the Vaubohm family, and I'm not sure which one this would have been. John, do you?
Jean.
Jean Vaubohm, okay. Would have made this. Thank you, John. The guitar, much like the violin and cello family was parallel to the viola da gamba family, the guitar and the lute family were always in existence, but again, in... varying stages of popularity or lack thereof among the aristocracy. And so the guitar in its early days in the sort of Renaissance times was sort of for strumming, playing, you know, drinking, dancing, you know, much like it is today. Around the time this guitar would have been made, it would have been very popular with Louis XIV. He loved to dance. And this is it's meant for strumming and playing dance music. And so he studied the instrument, and I think he was maybe actually pretty good at it.
Well, maybe we can persuade my later guest, Bill T. Jones, to dance a little bit to your guitar music.
let's do it.
I will try to post a photo of this beautiful instrument at klw.org after the show, because it really is something. Tell us a bit about the inside of that guitar. It's got some interesting lace work.
Yeah, so this is the rosette. And... on John's theorbo, which he will talk about in just a moment, there's a very flat decoration over the sound hole. For those of us listening, we've all probably seen acoustic guitars with just sort of an open sound hole. And so this could have that, but mine actually has a parchment rose sitting in there. And so it's actually carved in three dimensions, so it actually goes several inches into the instrument. And it's made of parchment that's been sprayed with some sort of
hardener,
shellac-y fixative kind of thing. I'm not really sure, honestly.
Uh-huh. And there's a lot more strings than a traditional guitar, so tell us about
Actually more like a 12-string guitar. So a 12-string guitar today, like you would have heard it on, say, like Turn, Turn, Turn by the Byrds.
Mm-hmm.
It's 12 strings played in pairs, so so it's like six strings just played twice. And so this actually has nine strings on it, and in the lute and early guitar world, we call a pair of strings, or sometimes a single string, a course. So this is a five-course guitar.
And delicious.
And delicious, yes, yes. You need something else for dessert, but it's
well, I think we're getting to the Theorbo for dessert.
That is certainly going to be the dessert. And so...
Give us a sound of those different strings. Is it mostly for resonance, then? Are they duplicate strings?
Yes, so my highest pitch string... This is tuned very similarly to the modern guitar. So my highest pitch string is an E. And it's single. And then the rest of them are doubled. So I have two unisons. And then one octave. And then a reentrant fifth course. So that means that it's in a higher octave than you would normally expect it to be.
And what sort of a physics degree do you need to keep all that straight?
You just need to go to music school and not really do much else.
It's beautiful, beautiful playing. Last but far from least is David Walker, who's... John Lenti, who's on Theorbo, who must have a challenge taking that onto various modes of transportation, public and otherwise.
It's quite true. It's a pain to travel with it, and if your listeners could get a really close look, they could see some of the battle scars where... I think every major airline has now destroyed this instrument at least once.
Oh, my.
But they always manage to put it back together again somehow.
It's not a folding Theorbo either.
Unfortunately, no. They do make such a thing does exist, but I haven't gotten the conversion job done on this yet.
Uh-huh. And tell us a little bit about this instrument.
So the Theorbo, the Theorbo is the biggest member of the lute family. The lute is that family of instruments with the teardrop-shaped body and the bowl-shaped back. Usually looks kind of like a boat or a gourd or something. And when you see an angel on a Christmas card with one, typically there's a place where the neck bends back at an angle. And that's kind of, you know, the classical lute. Now, the Theorbo is the family of lutes where they wanted more bass. And so it's a double-necked instrument. It's got seven short strings and seven long strings, a total of 14 strings. The seven short strings, I play them just like a guitar. I fret them and pluck and strum. And then I've got these seven long strings that are twice as long, and them I never really touch with my left hand. I just pluck them with my right hand, and it's kind of like having the bottom range of a harp tacked onto your guitar.
Sound.
So between
two
sets of strings, I've got a complete accompanist here.
Nice. Yeah. Well, we'll hear from the full ensemble in just a minute, but we're going to talk with Dorothy Manley about the full season of the San Francisco Early Music Society, which begins with Ostraca on Friday, tomorrow in Palo Alto, Saturday in Berkeley, and then Sunday in San Francisco. Dorothy Manley is the operations manager for the San Francisco Early Music Society, and she joins me in studio as well. Hi, Dorothy.
Hello, David. Thanks so much for having me.
Sure. Well, you got a heck of a start to the season here.
Don't I have a good backup crew?
Well, one thing that caught my eye about the season is that for the first time, San Francisco Early Music Society is going to be doing some new music.
Yes.
As in contemporary music. Did you have revolts on the board when that was proposed?
No, or was this actually, this was, it was interesting. The process of San Francisco Early Music Society getting to early music was facilitated by Roy Weldon, who is a member of the Galax Quartet, who will actually be performing this music and for whom the music was written. And he himself is a contemporary composer of contemporary music. And so he has been interested in involving early music instruments with modern compositions for a very long time. This will be the West Coast premiere of a piece written for the Galax Quartet by Joseph Schwantner. And the concert will also have some of Roy's own writings in it. And this will be paired in the Galax concert, which will be, it will be the weekend of January 31st, February 1st, and February 2nd. This early music, new music on early instruments, will be paired with some very new-sounding music in from the 17th and 18th century. These will be pieces by Gesualdo and Luzzaschi, who wrote some extraordinarily odd-sounding music for its time. It was very chromatic, very sinuous, a lot of crunches and sort of a dark sound, tonalities that was shocking in a way in its day. So this will be a really fun concert and an opportunity to show off some brand new music in the context of some music that was very new in its own day. Mm. And that indeed is a bit of a theme for this season's concerts.
That's great. And I'm sure we'll have some other guests on as your season progresses.
Yes.
It also includes some works in December, a Magnificat. The group founded and directed by Warren Stewart, the Galax Quartet, as you mentioned, with contralto Karen Clark, Quicksilver in February, and the Farallon Recorder Quartet coming up later this spring.
Yes, and I should also mention that the Quicksilver concert is another first. It will be the West Coast premiere of that organization in our concert series.
Fantastic. And more information at sfems.org. We'll talk with you again, I'm sure, but I wanted to get some more music in, and I wanted to have Josh talk to just a little bit about what this program, Leaving Parnassus, what is this theme of this concert that's opening things up?
So the way I tell people that aren't really well steeped in early music is that you're witnessing a battle of fashion. Kind of akin to what you see now as far as like a couture and like just fashion. Like there's a very Italian perspective and there's a French perspective, and a lot of things just kind of drop, you know, somewhere in between those two poles. This program, Leaving Parnassus, is about the kind of the development of this high Baroque French style, which is very different from music that you might be familiar with, like Vivaldi, Bach. Like it's a lot more moody. The music swings a lot more. But the thing that was happening while this whole style was being developed in Paris in the 17th century and in the 18th is the things from the south, from Italy, were very fashionable to the Parisians. And slowly, the Italians won. And this French style that Louis the 14th and his dance master, Lully, who have went on to invent the French opera, what they worked so hard to create eventually just it slipped like a hemline. Like it became it just was out of fashion all of a sudden. So the program traces music from a very, very high developed French place until like with the Corette, which we just played, the only thing French about that music in a lot of ways is the very front page of the publication. And everything else, and the composer, and everything else is Italian. Like, literally, you turn the page, and it's like, everything's Italian. There's no French language left in that book.
Huh.
And it's just, you know, it's they drug French style out into the street, and they said, later, you know.
and you're committed to kind of discovering some of these works that are less familiar.
Absolutely. I mean, we play instruments that are usually more accompanimental. We accompany singers and other instrumentalists a lot, and the three of us make a lot of our living doing that. But there's a large corpus of work for all three of these instruments, and they just don't get pursued that often. So the three of us have taken a chance to, I don't know, just look under the hood, past the greatest hits. You know, we're all familiar with you know, Bach and Vivaldi and Telemann and Handel, and those guys are great, don't get me wrong, but there's a large world of music that's just as fascinating. But you just have to have some funky, odd instruments with some odd-looking guys playing it to make it a little bit more accessible, I guess.
And we'll hear that tomorrow in Palo Alto or Saturday in Berkeley, Sunday in San Francisco. Again, information about Ostraca and the full season of the San Francisco Early Music Ensemble at sfems.org. Let's hear some more music, and I thank you once again for coming into the studios. Tell us what we're going to hear once we get that mic adjusted.
I need to tune just a minute, because I've got a bunch of new strings on, and they're going to stretch.
Well, speaking of ancient composers, you're doing some tuning now, right?
Yeah, right?
Chinese composer, I believe.
But we're going to play, it's a chaconne by Marin Marais. Marais was he was a viola da gamba player himself, quite a virtuoso, and he was the second head of the French opera after Lully stabbed himself in the foot and died from gangrene. No, he did. He really did.
Fascinating story.
He really did. But the chaconne is a really popular dance. It's kind of a combination of a minuet, which is in three, and a sarabande, which is a slow dance in three. And it's a set of variations. But I'm going to tune my floppy gut strings. And but it's a set of variations. I mean, you'll hear it like it's a familiar chord progression as we go through the whole piece. All right. Thank you.
That's Josh Lee on viola da gamba, John Lenti on theorbo, and David Walker on baroque guitar. They are Ostraca. The program is Leaving Parnassus, some virtuosic solo and ensemble music for this very trio. It opens the San Francisco Early Music Society Fall Concerts this Friday in Palo Alto, Saturday in Berkeley, and Sunday in San Francisco. Tickets are available online at their website. You can learn more about the full season of the Early Music Society there, sfems.org. Gentlemen, thanks so much for taking some time today.
Thank you.
Well, my next guest, among his many honors and awards, have been a MacArthur Genius Award, Kennedy Center Honors in 2010. He was inducted into the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in 2009 and was named an irreplaceable dance treasure by the Dance Heritage Coalition. His ventures into Broadway resulted in Tony Awards in 2007 and 2010. And there's a career retrospective going on at the Yerba Buena Center here in San Francisco, which will also include the world premiere and West Coast premiere of works by him. It is indeed an honor to welcome legendary choreographer Bill T. Jones to our studio day.
It's great to be here.
Hi, Bill. A 30-year retrospective at Yerba Buena Center. Do you have a special relationship with Yerba Buena that has led to this special honor?
Well, the Bay Area in general, but Yerba Buena in particular, they have been very, very supportive over the years. And Ken Foster, who has just given over the role to Mark Bamuti Joseph, they have been real champions of the company, and we're very, very grateful.
So how do you look back on your own career of 30 years of creating dance? I mean, nowadays there's a technology for preserving it digitally and video-wise. How do you have all of your stuff notated somehow, or is it all video?
Well, I sit here and I look at these really talented musicians playing these beautiful instruments. There's something that, as a badge of honor, we for years would hold on to. Is unlike the sheet music that has marks on the page, our art form exists in the minds of people who've practiced it and who are able to articulate it from generation to generation. I am of the generation that video has been a part of, but some of us are quite militant that when you see something on video, you're not really seeing what dance is. Dance is real people in real time performing for real people in real time. And dance has the drama of theater, as the Greeks would have understood it, because the dance performance, one never knows how it's going to end, because it is in life. It could all go wrong. But more often than not, it turns into a wonderful communal situation. So I try not to spend a lot of time looking back. That's for the scholars and academics to do, because I'm right there in the trenches trying to make the next thing or to pull an unruly generation to pull their attention to talk about what we want to discover.
Speaking of which, there's a terrific documentary you can find on YouTube of the series called Masterclass that features you as mentor to some young dancers and choreographers.
Making their life miserable.
Well, I think keeping them to task might be a way to think about it.
No, it's true. Get them
to think outside their own little box.
Mm-hmm. It's true. It's true. And it's a great privilege to make art. And it's a great privilege to have a body that's capable of doing it. And sometimes maybe youth doesn't quite respect that privilege enough.
Well, I hate to bring it up, but speaking of the body and aging, how are you dealing with the fact that as you're getting older, muscles are changing?
I'm not dancing anymore.
Oh, you're not? Okay.
No, I'm very flattered that. And I was that last tune. I did want to get up and do a few steps, but there's no room here. I sometimes flippantly say I dance when I'm very, very happy. Or very, very altered, I should say.
Is that like singing in the shower, maybe?
No, when my companion is cooking or if I'm in a house, a party, my friend with a big living room, I will get up and move. Dance, my last public performance was actually in the Louvre in Paris.
Way to go out, Bill.
Yeah,
that's nice.
I tell you. In my green room was the Mona Lisa. but that was the last time I officially danced, and we were something very ambitious, 450 feet from the Michelangelo's bound slave all the way to the winged victory. That's quite a gallery of sculptures.
This is a big centenary year for Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. Mm. Many strictly orchestral presentations, including here in San Francisco. Some direct recreations of the Nijinsky choreography and costumes. And now, including here at the San Francisco Ballet, you've co-created with theater director Anne Bogart and Janet Wong, the associate artistic director of Bill T. Jones' Arnie Zane Dance, a rite. More of a theater piece than a performance of ballet.
I don't know if we'd say that. We call it dance theater. For the aficionados out there, when you say dance theater, you think of Pina Bausch. And yes, she is a great practitioner of it, but it's a much older tradition than that. It is, we have set out to avoid the pitfalls, I think, of being too much in love with a great masterpiece. And the Rite of Spring comes with its own outlandish story of a opening night riot and all of that stuff that people love. We're not even sure if it was true. Yes, people were fighting in the aisles, but did Diaghilev, in all of his showman smarts, really orchestrate it because he wanted a scandal? We'll never know. So we were both invited separately by Emil Kong, a very enlightened impresario at Chapel Hill, to respond to the 100th anniversary of this masterpiece. I was in complete disagreement with the idea of doing yet another rite. Once again, we're going to weigh in on our ability to provoke and so on. Nijinsky did it. There's some really wonderful ones out there. But Anne Bogart, because she comes from a theater tradition, they were fresh to it. Every dancer knows about the riot and knows about the turned in feet and knows about the first time Parisian audiences had seen primitivism, quote, which is already, as an African American, that's a bit of an offensive idea considering what they considered primitive is what people were throwing down every day in Harlem, and which was soon to be the rage throughout Europe during the Charleston. But at that moment, it was an affront to be watching these people do it. I didn't want to do that. Anne loved the story, and because Anne is an incredibly persuasive and intelligent woman, I said, what the devil? Let's see if we throw ourselves into this. The first great thing that we ran into was meeting Severin Neff. Severin Neff is one of the most erudite and intelligent. She's a Schoenberg scholar, but she agreed with Emil Kong to do a Rite of Spring or Stravinsky celebration. She is a real hoot. When you come to see this performance, our lead actress, Ellen Lauren, you cannot believe that this character is not is real. But as Anne said the other night, as strange as Ellen's portrayal is, the real woman is more odd. But she knows her stuff. So she talks you through the order in which he created things. And he created things in a way that our internet playlist generation would understand, literally on kind of scorecards. He would write out something, and then he'd line it up on the wall, and he'd just take this piece arbitrarily. I don't know if it's arbitrarily, but and just change it. When you listen to it, you can see the transitions are angular. Sometimes they're not there. It was a very audacious thing to do. He, too, was quite calculating. He wanted to make a modernism that would hit them right between the eyes. Now, as she says in the piece, there were many riots. I mean, they were rioting all the time in Vienna over Schoenberg's work. But this one had a particular kind of taste to it. Was it because the year before had been the very famous Afternoon of a Faun, wherein Nijinsky is said to have, at the end, ground his hips suggestively, simulating orgasm? The whole room couldn't believe it. Was it an improvisation, or was it the grapes around his waist were uncomfortable, so he moved at the last moment when he was lying down? Whatever. It sold out. Everyone was there. And she says, Severin goes on to say, that perhaps that's why the next year everyone was paying such attention.
Sure,
they were waiting for the scandal.
Mm-hmm.
And they got a scandal.
They did.
As you know, the Rite of Spring begins with that very beautiful oboe part.
Da, da, da. Actually, bassoon, we have it.
Bassoon. But then the augers kicks in, and she describes it as a migraine. And talk about the howling that went up to heaven about how are we listening to this madness. So that's when the riot started. Now, this is all the lore. We wanted to make a work that addressed not only that night, but what is new. And what is the difference between 1913 and 2013? A very simple question, but huge in its ramifications. It's like it's a different planet. So that's what a rite is. It is trying to deal with what this work means to us now, and in a way, look past that work. It's something about the nature of trying to hear differently, trying to be differently.
Mm-hmm. And the theater aspect of it also includes someone recreating a role as a World War I soldier. Is that correct?
Well, yes, it didn't begin that way. Initially, we were going to have this kind of heartbreaking existential character called the Walking Man. But when Anne began to pull together the various testimonies from soldiers and poetry and all, this character emerged. And as you know, there was a tradition. Well, there are those who say that the Rite of Spring was predicted the First World War. And so our man, we find him when he is coming from someplace and going someplace. There's two things going on in this work. Yes, we are saying no to Nijinsky's and Stravinsky's libretto that has its sacrificial maiden and all. Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming your audience all knows the story, the original story. So sacrifice was very, very important. And, of course, in patriarchal society, the sacrifice is a young, pretty girl, the youngest, most virginal girl. So we were thinking, what does sacrifice look like now? And there is the age-old sacrifice of young men being chewed up because of the ideals and the squabbles of their elders.
Right.
So I won't say more than that, other than we start with a musicologist talking about that night. We meet an astrophysicist who's very similar to Brian Greene. As a matter of fact, Brian Greene gave us permission to use some of his texts from, I believe it's The Fabric of the Cosmos. I'm a big fan. And it ends on this note of this person who, quote, hears the world differently.
Hmm.
Unfortunately, you have every day more and more people who hear something in their head that tells them to go out and create mayhem. It's almost become en passant, casual now.
And are you using, therefore, music other than Stravinsky, or in addition to?
Well, yes, we take liberties with looping. You know, the famous 11 hits, boom, 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 at the moment when the sacrifice is happening. Well, that 11 hits now is about 22 or so,
okay.
And they are loud,
yeah.
You know. We sing Stravinsky, because when Janet Wong, my brilliant associate director, and I decided we were going to do this old war horse, we've got to embody it. So we had to learn those rhythms, and as you know, those are famously challenging rhythms, and we have to be able to clap them and stomp them, and we have to be able to sing. And have you ever tried singing? You guys are the musicians sitting here to my right, talented musicians, but we're not singers. Sing dissonant harmony a cappella. This this is one of the problems we assign to ourselves. And it's quite, it's a very uncanny sound.
So a rite by Bill T. Jones, along with Anne Bogart, will have its West Coast premiere this weekend, starting tomorrow at the Yerba Buena Center. Also on the work, world premiere of your work, Time Study One. Could you share with us just a little details about that? Oh, nice.
Yes. Well, Time Study is the child of Story Time, and Story Time is a work inspired by John Cage's famous indeterminacy, where on a stage, I believe in Berlin in 1958, he sat and he read 90 stories in 90 minutes using a stopwatch. And the stories were banal, sublime, across the board. I thought that John Cage, being the great giver of permission, wouldn't mind if I used him as a kind of a encouragement and a provocation. And I wrote my own stories. And we did a work that has chance occurrences that are arranged every night through random.org. We don't throw the I Ching, as John Cage did. And then it got rid of Bill. And we came to San Francisco being invited to work in a wonderful alternative space called Counterpulse and to create something. So we did. We had rehearsed it in New York, but we made a version in this space that is on the clock, 60 minutes from beginning to end, and there's a huge clock so you can see everything. And there are very odd things that go on, but because of the grid of time, the events take on another kind of, there's something empirical, something actual about them that you don't normally see in such expressionistic work. It was a wonderful experience. I feel I know the ecology, to quote our presenter, the ecology of the creative community in San Francisco that much better. And now we're ready to go to the Yerba Buena and turn our attention elsewhere.
Very nice. Those performances will be Friday and Saturday at 8, Sunday at 3. Also, there's a post-show Q&A with the artists on Friday evening. Information at ybca.org. Among the many other things celebrating the incredible legacy and living legacy of Bill T. Jones, there'll be tonight a reception about the at the upstairs galleries at Yerba Buena Center, featuring highlights from the 30th anniversary celebration of Bill's work. A masterclass on Saturday, and Saturday there's also some documentaries being done at the screening room, including Bill Moyer's journal on Bill and a documentary called Bill T. Jones, A Good Man. Bill, thanks so much for taking just a little bit of time today. I know you've got a lot on your plate here in San Francisco, and I hope you enjoy your stay.
It was a real pleasure. It was a real pleasure hearing you gentlemen play as well.
And more information, again, at the Yerba Buena Center website, ybca.org. We'll hear just a brief excerpt from those famous opening lines of the Stravinsky as we go to a pre-recorded interview segment with Peter Robinson. I'm David LaTulipe, and it's Open Air on KALW. Critic, bon vivant, and general man about town, Peter Robinson joins me once again in studio to share some cultural happenings. Peter, welcome back.
Hi, David. Good to be here. And I've had a sneak preview at the upcoming David Hockney exhibition at the De Young. It's not opened yet, but some of these huge paintings have already appeared in the Royal Academy. I saw them in London, and then I've very carefully gone through what they are promising in their catalogue. So first let me just qualify. It's called a bigger exhibition, and I want to take a quick look at that adjective because I think, in fact, it is the biggest Hockney exhibition, bigger than anything else which has been shown around Europe, with over 300 different pieces, from watercolours to still life. There's digital and moving photographs, and there is everything you would call or expect from Hockney: rich, vibrant colours, but there's also some beautiful charcoal etchings. So if you want a variety of David Hockney's work, if I could use a musical term, I would call this Hockney Unplugged. This is really a show to be seen. Now, let me deal with the word size, too, because some of these canvases are 8 foot wide, 5 foot deep. They fill an entire wall. And one of the things that he really emphasizes is that he likes to see things from a multiple point of view, from multiple points of view. And I think the other thing I should repeat, and I'm going to say it twice, Hockney is not a pop art artist. He is something else, and something else means, I think, in my opinion, very great. He lives part of the year in Hollywood, so some of the paintings are of the Hollywood Hills, but he also journeys back to his parents' home. They're both dead now, which is in Bridlington, Yorkshire. And the reason I bring that up is that he is fascinated by colour, but he's also fascinated by season. And some of the paintings, particularly the Yorkshire paintings, show summer, fall, winter, spring. And he goes back to the same scenes, and he will then repeat the same set of trees, but this time with different foliage. So in some paintings, you've got snow on the ground. Others, you've got vibrant colour. and in some instances you've got bark trees. This sense of how the seasons change, which, as I say, in England, but not necessarily Hollywood, is important, is his way of immersing the viewer in the painting. And he believes in involvement. You're not just there as a spectator, you're there as part of Hockney's work. And what a vibrant and what an extensive sort of study of his entire work is. He's extremely prolific. He's now 76 years old. And I think I'll just say a few words about the digital paintings and digital photography, because more recently he has been working on an iPad. So you actually have someone who's totally contemporary in his modern art and totally contemporary in how he puts the work down. And then these are then transferred and they're on show. Some of them are huge projections. And then he has another device, which I think is reminds me of those Google cars that drive around with cameras on top, where he has video cameras recording as he drives in the van the same scene from many, many different angles. And he has compiled a series of moving pictures, which, again, is in one room alone.
It's so wonderful to see him still evolving that way and embracing the digital age rather than being, you know, someone that just puts it aside saying, well, not so much for me.
That's absolutely right, is that what you feel, you get the totality. And all this work is done over the last 10 years. So it's not just bringing stuff back from the 60s. This is contemporary works which he's done. And as I say, the moving camera is a phrase you'll often find that he uses, and he calls it the tyranny of a single perspective. So with his moving camera, he gives you multiple perspectives, multiple points of view. And as a result, when you go into this exhibition and you really go into it, you find that you're in several different rooms, several different styles of painting. Some of them, particularly the still life, are in watercolors. There are magnificent pictures of flowers in vases or vases, we say over here, self-portraits. And in fact, an interesting touch is the portrait on the catalogue, which is called Self-Portrait with Charlie, at this very moment is in customs. And because of the government shutdown, they are hoping that and seven other works will be out in time. That's if Congress gets its act together and finally releases government employees to release David Hockney's paintings, and they hope will be on show. And just a final word, this is one of the best catalogues I've seen. It's put together with essays by different people. The actual curator, Gregory Evans, has put the overall catalogue together, but there was an excellent essay by Richard Benfield, a magnificent introduction, which I think gives you the style of the exhibition by Colin Bailey. And I think this is a good example where reading ahead of time can give you an insight as to what you're going to find on the walls. So that is my tip for this upcoming fall. If there's one art show that you're going to see, the De Hockney exhibition at the De Young is the place for you.
Well, how lucky for us to have it here in San Francisco beginning October 26th. More information about the exhibition at deyoung.famsf.org. Peter will be back in a moment with a movie review. Stay with us.
Thank you.
number 1 from Johann Sebastian Bach's Partita number 1 in B flat major, pianist András Schiff, who's giving us the gift of sharing his marvelous talents this month in his return to perform the music of Johann Sebastian Bach on solo piano. Information at sfperformances.org. Good afternoon, David LaTulipe with Peter Robinson once again. Peter, let's go to the movies.
Let's go to the movies. And in fact, I'm going to go to a question for listeners. How many trailers have you heard begun or begin with?
In a world.
In a world where your ears are bigger than your head and your tongue is longer than... Well, there we go. In fact, In a World is the title of... I consider it to be an excellent movie on the voiceover business. And when I say voiceover business, it's amazing how extensive that business is. It not only includes audio books, where often the narrator can turn a bad book into a good book, and the similar, the reverse. I've seen excellent books ruined by a bad narrator. You can even get artists to answer your telephone. In a world, this is 5454, and off they go. So the voice carries. And the storyline behind this particular movie, In a World, is by Lake Bell, about a young artist wanting to break into the voiceover business. And from there on out, there are a series of coincidences about who has the best voice and why. And sometimes why a certain voice, good though it may be, is not necessarily the best voice for that particular movie. And she has a couple of bedroom intrigues, which, of course, add to the voice behind the voice. And in the end, I would say this is a strong feminist movie showing that In a World is often said by a male voice, but in fact, in certain situations, it could be better said in a female voice. So if you're looking for an interesting film, in fact, I think it's the only one I can recall that is about the voice industry, which is a huge industry. For example, with the audio book industry, they have a thing called the Audio Awards, which is simply based on how books are read, and I've been a judge at that a couple of times. But beyond that, there are the trailers, and the trailers come with that dramatic moment, here we go, In a World, and you're suddenly engrossed in what the movie or the trailer is about.
You have to be drawn in by that, because otherwise you're off to get some popcorn.
You're off to get to some popcorn, and then the audience is dead. They're not listening. Now, as you and I both know, radio is the theatre of the mind, and the way the pitch is put out there, the inflection, the tone, and I often think the speed can sometimes convey a lack of urgency. I'm amazed today, having grown up in the world of Eric Severoid and Walter Cronkite, how the news now is speeded up at high power, high speed, so that even a minor incident is given the same sense of urgency as a world disaster.
Indeed, I think at the ripe old age of 50, Peter, I'm one of the last of a generation that used to hear, you know, Walter Cronkite and CBS Evening News every night, and that must have instilled in me what a voice is supposed to sound like on the radio.
Well, I did...
or TV, for that matter.
Yeah, I did work, in fact, with Alistair Cook, and KLW was one of the last stations to carry Letter from America. Mm-hmm. And in terms of timing, until... the very end, his sense of timing absolutely drew you in, because he felt he had a story to tell and you were going to be the beneficiaries of how he told that story.
And as we know, the radio is a very powerful medium, and how it's delivered is very important.
And sometimes deep breathing, breathing in the moment of a thriller can absolutely draw you in. I've noticed a tendency, and I'm not in favor of this, in some of the audio thrillers, they're using what I call Hitchcock-type scary music. And to me, a good voice can create that atmosphere without the signaling. So I think one of the changes I've seen in voiceover business is essentially that music, instead of being helpful, sometimes tells you, now listen up, because this is the part of the story where something's going to happen. Whereas I always feel a good narrator...
Peter Robinson discussing In a World... movie. And once again, Peter will join us in a couple of weeks for some more features here on KALW. Well, it is a coincidence of birthdays today. Thelonious Monk and
Giuseppe Verdi. I flipped a coin earlier and came up with some music of Verdi for you. The famous second act duet from Don Carlo. Here's Don Carlo singing with Rodrigo, their Oath of Friendship from the second act. You'll hear Placido Domingo and Cheryl Milnes in this classic recording. Placido Domingo as Don Carlo, Cheryl Milnes as Rodrigo, from the classic 1970 recording on EMI, Carla Maria Giulini conducting Verdi's Don Carlo. I'm David LaTulipe. You've been listening to Open Air. A reminder that our shows are archived at klw.org. You can send me some feedback and some show suggestions there as well. Thanks, as always, to my co-producer, Neil Swinkles, for making it all run as smoothly as possible in our humble Studio A here at KALW, and I invite you to join me next week at the same time, same location, or listen online at klw.org.